Bienvenidos and welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. I am your host, Matthew Miranda, welcoming you to episode 95. I have mostly been, as we've been nearing episode 100, sharing with you memories or memorable athletes that I associate with the number of the episode. I'm not going to do that for 95. Instead, I'm going to explain to you why I was recently made to feel like I'm 95 years old. I do not often listen to old episodes of this show. I was mortified to do so last week because someone had asked me for a recent episode featuring an interview. So I shared the interview I did a few weeks ago when we had Lindsay D'Arcangelo on to talk. And I noticed, listening to the old episode, that I was talking about hockey, and I told the story of how when I was young, I was drawn to hockey because of the music and the unique qualities of the language, the names and everything. And I realized, listening to that in the Lindsay D'Arcangelo episode, that I must do this literally like every time I talk about hockey on this pod, which isn't a ton, which makes me think, though, that I must have told that story on this podcast like 5 or 6 different times. I apologize to you as listeners. I'm getting older. The number of moments where I realize I'm getting older are increasing. For example, I realized the other day that the only person who ever tells me I'm still young is my father, who is in his 70s. It's very sweet. If you're listening, Ed, I always love it and appreciate it. But it's hard not to notice that the only person telling you that you're young is closer to 80 than 60. Also, another reminder of my rapid erosion, I went to the supermarket today. I drove there to pick up an order of groceries I had put in. So they just come out and, you know, put the bags in your car and you're done with Instacart. And it was taking a while. So I called into the store, and when they answered the phone, I asked if they would refer me to the Instagram department. Fortunately, the young girl did not laugh and was culturally bilingual and understood that I meant Instacart, not Instagram. But just a couple of ways that I am feeling old as hell of late, which is not always a bad thing. Today's episode will take the shape of one that we had a few weeks ago, where I'm going to do a couple of little bits here, and then we'll get to the interview portion with the guest. So I want to introduce the guest just quickly to you now. Noah Dalzell is an incredible rising sports writer who covers the Boston Celtics and the WNBA. But if you read her work, and I gave her all 3 pages in the interview, you can also find her anywhere at Noah, N-O-A, and then D-A-L-Z-E-L-L. Writes about everything. Writes like analytics pieces, writes narrative-based pieces, interviews. Former Celtics has a great piece from recently with the father of a current Celtic, Derek White. This really, really lovely piece about how that man has kind of made it his point to go on Celtic Twitter and try to diffuse some of the ugly, like, ad hominem personal stuff that you see all over the place on every team's NBA Twitter, it seems. Wrote a wonderful, wonderful piece that we talked about in the interview about the NBA's failure to respond to domestic violence with any kind of consistent authority and care. Basically, any kind of writing that someone can do in the world of sports, Noah Dalzell seems to do it and seems to do it really well. So this is my first time meeting her, first time speaking with her. It was really cool. We talked about the Celtics for a while, and then the last part of the interview was about her piece about domestic violence. So that will come after my little bits here. I just want to get into a few things with you before cutting to the interview. One, I literally didn't even know about this until a couple hours ago. This morning I saw a link or a quick allusion somewhere online to Draymond Green and suspensions, and I thought it had to be a slightly dated article from when he choked out Rudy Gobert recently. I had no idea. Just a busy time of work, and I didn't really see any NBA stuff this morning. I had no idea that Draymond Green had again last night assaulted a coworker. So let's get to this Draymond story. Last night, Golden State was playing Phoenix. Draymond was in a mix-up with Yusuf Nurkic, the Suns center. He's an enormous, enormous, enormous human being. His father was larger, actually. Nurkic's father was a bouncer in Bosnia, and he was apparently close to 7 feet, 400 pounds. So I'm going to guess that bar had pretty good behavior. But Nurkic himself, Yusuf, is a large, one of the bigger players in the NBA. Draymond was apparently trying to get position on him to post or set up. I don't know what. And in the process of trying to get position, Draymond wheeled around with his arms extended and smacked the shit out of Nurkic in the face. And Nurkic went down to the ground. Green was ejected. Green will be undoubtedly facing a suspension by the NBA. He maintains, and for what it's worth, in this case, I believe him. I don't think that really makes any difference. But Draymond is insisting in this case, this was not him trying to hurt somebody. This was him just trying to draw the ref's attention, making a basketball play, if you consider appealing for a foul, a basketball play. He apologized to Nurkic after the game, insisted it was not intentional. The problem here is that this is like the boy who cried wolf, insisting that, well, this time it's not intentional. Yeah, maybe. Maybe the evidence even points to that. But the obvious failing here is that Draymond Green has made a career out of assaulting or assailing teammates and opponents. And at this point, it's been going on for about a decade. So you don't have any credibility. I'm not going to pile on Draymond right now because I think that speaks for itself. I think he has his legacy. He has his track record. He's going to be judged by it accordingly. And whether it's fair or not in this case, you don't get to assault people for 10 years, often in extremely over-the-top ways, and then complain that now this time the punishment's not fair. You don't get to do that. But I want to give you just a quick rundown of this person's history, not to pile on Draymond, but to point the finger, I think, at where a lot of it needs to go and is immediately forgotten about in this kind of story, and that's towards his employer, towards the Golden State Warriors. So Draymond, you go back to 2016 when the Warriors won a 73-game season and they were trying to cap off what would have been the greatest individual season any team has ever had, and they were up famously or infamously 3-1 in the finals in the best of seven against Cleveland. And at the end of a loss in game four, when it was obvious that the game was lost in the final seconds, Cleveland was going to win, or it was going to go 3-1, whatever it was. I guess Golden State was going to win to go up 3-1. LeBron stepped over Draymond when he was on the ground. This is considered in basketball an obvious gesture of disrespect. Draymond made it his business to throw kind of a lunge punch toward LeBron's groin area. And because Draymond had already accumulated a certain number of flagrant points for flagrant fouls during the whole playoffs, the gesture towards LeBron put him over the top point-wise. He was suspended. And of course, this is when Cleveland came back, won the last three games, won the series. So Draymond literally, after 2016, had already cost his team a championship by his completely unregulated rage and behavior. We start there. On more than one occasion, Draymond has gone pretty much knee up right into Steven Adams' groin. More than once. In 2019, when Kevin Durant was a Warrior, there was a game against the Clippers, very end of regulation. Draymond tried to go up the floor with it and hit the winning shot. He did not. Durant was bothered by this. They had a very heated exchange on the sideline and evidently afterwards also behind closed doors. And both players have acknowledged that that helped pave the way for Durant to leave, that whatever was said and done was ugly enough and intense enough and directed enough, because Draymond has acknowledged, yeah, that was a turning point for KD leaving, and Durant has said it was a turning point. So by 2019, Green's behavior has cost the team a title, and it's also cost them arguably their best player and inarguably what would have been more titles had he stayed. Green has fought Bradley Beal in a game and come out of it with like half his jersey completely shredded. He's kicked out at Herb Jones. Let us not forget that just a little over a year ago, Draymond Green was caught on film in a practice facility punching out his own teammate, Jordan Poole. Now, this is where I get to. This is not all about Draymond. This is also about Golden State. So Draymond punches out his coworker in what is supposed to be a safe place. It's a workplace. It's a practice court. And he punches out his teammate on camera. Total sucker punch. This wasn't two people squaring off, deciding to have a duel, and the better man won. He completely sucker punched someone half a foot smaller than him and much smaller and nowhere near as strong. He sucker punched him. Golden State did not suspend Draymond Green for this. And if you want precedent, years before this, the Chicago Bulls had an incident where Bobby Portis punched his teammate, Nikola Mirotic, in the face. The Bulls suspended Portis for 8 games. The Warriors did not suspend Green for anything. Not only did they not suspend Green for anything, but Green was up for a new contract when this happened. The Warriors traded Jordan Poole, the victim, and at the end of the year, they gave a contract extension to Draymond. If you find yourself thinking, yeah, but Draymond's a Hall of Fame. He's a much better player. Draymond is essential. Like, Golden State really can't win without him. Jordan Poole is superfluous. If that's where your head went, that's the problem here. At some point, when does it stop being about, well, we have to put up with this. We have to let it go because he's a really good basketball player. He helps us win. So what are we supposed to do? Well, you're supposed to do something, because then even at the end of last year, they got to the playoffs. He gets ejected from a critical playoff game for stomping on the chest of Domantas Sabonis, an opponent who was on his back. It was in game six, I believe it was game six of that series. I don't remember the game. I do remember Draymond stomping on his chest. And then afterwards, in Sacramento, in a hostile opponent's building, yelling, screaming at the crowd, riling them up, antagonizing them, playing the heel. Okay. Then this year, you have Green suspended for putting the chokehold on Rudy Gobert when a fight broke out with two other players, neither of which was Gobert. But Draymond, who has made a long habit out of criticizing Gobert, insulting Gobert, antagonizing Gobert, slandering Gobert, physically going after Gobert, had an opportunity and immediately put him in a chokehold. And now, again, we have him hitting Nurkic in the face, facing another suspension. But friends, Romans, countrymen, I come not to bury Draymond. I think he's done a good enough job of that on his own. The indictment here is with the Warriors. The indictment is that the Warriors, at the end of all of this, look like what they are, which is hypocrites. This is an organization whose owner, Joe Lacob, made a point when they were winning lots of games about how his team, how his franchise was, quote, light years ahead of the rest of the league in all different sorts of ways. That's why Golden State was such a great special team and dynasty, unlike everybody else. Now what you see? No, you're like every other team. You got lucky in the draft. You got lucky to get Steph Curry. You got lucky that he turned out to make himself into what he's become as a pro. And you're just like every other organization where, whether you're letting a rapist play soccer because he's going to help you win goals, or whether you're going to let someone who attacks and assaults women continue to play, quarterback for you because he helps you win games, or you're going to let this guy stay on your basketball team and assault and assail teammates and opponents alike, because at the end of the day, all that matters is that you're winning games. They asked Steve Kerr about it. Steve Kerr, who I respected a lot, but I'm beginning to lose some respect for him, mostly because of his talk about Draymond. He always says the same shit. He's always saying something like, yeah, Draymond's got to know better. Okay, let's be real for a second. Draymond Green is not probably behaving this way because it just came to him out of the blue. this demonstrated history of problematic behavior for him and the people around him, the fact that it not only doesn't stop, but just continues and continues, says to me this is something internal. Whatever's going on with Draymond Green, where he feels in these situations he has to react excessively and that he's going to get away with it, that's all learned behavior. You have to unlearn that behavior. And the team repeatedly coming around to, well, you know, he helps us win. We don't like it, but he's got to learn. That doesn't mean anything. That doesn't mean anything. If you really cared about the player, if you really cared about the person, you would let him take an indefinite leave. You would make him take an indefinite leave and work on this so that 5 years after he's retired, he's been given the ability to better negotiate conflict in his life. Not continue to think that because he has money and because the people around him are always giving excuses that this is actually okay. I saw Dennis Rodman act a fool for many years. I saw Ron Artest / Meta World Peace, you know, cross the line a lot. I've never seen a player like Draymond Green where it's institutionally supported by his team. And then they sit back and act like they're not a part of it when it goes wrong. So really, this is shame on Golden State. You didn't suspend him when he assaulted a coworker. You gave him a new contract, and now you're surprised that he doesn't seem to get it. Sorry, this one's on Golden State. I hope Draymond gets a long suspension because I hope he has time to actually sit and meet with someone who can help him and maybe reflect on these actions. But for Golden State, like, please, enough of this from you. Moving on to the world of baseball. A very exciting story came out in the last, well, since whenever we had our last episode, Shohei Ohtani ending his free agency with not a dramatic announcement in terms of destination, but Ohtani announcing that he has signed a 10-year, $700 million contract with the Los Angeles Dodgers. It is the largest contract in baseball history. It is the largest contract in North American sports history. I am not familiar with any larger contracts than this, although soccer sometimes will surprise you. I can't remember someone ever signing in a team sport a contract bigger than this. And yet, what's interesting to me about this, looking at the larger finances and implications of the deal, is that while everyone's being pointed to, hey, look at this crazy, crazy contract. Isn't this crazy? Well, if you compare the revenues of Major League Baseball now versus, let's go back to 2001 for a very specific reason. In 2001, that was around the time that Major League Baseball for the first time had revenues that broke the billion-dollar mark. It might have been 99, 2000, or 2001. It was right around that point. That was the first time that they passed a billion. In 2001, Alex Rodriguez was a free agent. Baseball is the only sport in America that doesn't have a salary cap, so you can pay people whatever you want. And in 2001, Alex Rodriguez was easily the biggest free agent, the best player in the world. He was young, probably, he was certainly younger than Ohtani is now. And he signed, at the time, the biggest contract in North American sports history. He signed a 10-year deal for $252 million. The point of his deal was to make it slightly bigger than Kevin Garnett's in Minnesota because A-Rod wanted to be the highest paid player in American sports, and he was. Now remember, 2001, MLB revenue is $1 billion, and their highest paid player gets a $25 million a year deal. About a quarter century later, MLB revenues in 2022 earned a record just under $11 billion. So revenues were about 10 times what they were 21 years ago. So revenue is up 10, 11 times. Ohtani is not even making three times what A-Rod did. That to me seems, like that's curious. If I take... And Ohtani's a unique case because he's literally the only person in history that can hit and pitch at an all-star level in the major leagues. Like he does both. So he gets more money than anyone else ever would. The next biggest contract, I believe, is Mike Trout's. Mike Trout's annual salary is about $37 million. So the best player in the game today makes the best paid position player. Maybe it's not fair to compare Ohtani because he is a pitcher also, even though he's coming off now Tommy John surgery and he won't pitch next year. He is expected to pitch again and to pitch over the length of his deal, and he's a fabulous pitcher. So there is no one literally to compare him to. But if we take the best position player in the game, just a straight-up position player, which is usually regarded, he's had a lot of injuries the last few years, but when Mike Trout signed his contract, he signed as, okay, this is the guy. This is the best baseball player, non-pitcher on earth. He makes 50% more than A-Rod did in 2001. So revenues are up over 1,000% in baseball. But the highest salaries are up 50%. I didn't hear that talked about a lot this week, but I find that very interesting, disappointing, and weird. Because that money is going somewhere, and it's not going to the workers who are producing it. Two stories out of the NFL. One kind of a sad look at what is, and one an exciting glimpse at what may be. We saw another glimpse of just unchecked cishet raging lack of perspective. The Kansas City Chiefs, late in their game against the Buffalo Bills, literally in the last 20 seconds, I think, looked like they had won the game on this miracle lateral from Travis Kelce to Kadarius Toney. The play was canceled out because Toney was lined up offsides, which is rare on offense, but not unheard of. If you're on the line of scrimmage, you're offsides. Toney was on the line of scrimmage, so he was offside, so the play was canceled out by a penalty. It was the correct call, so naturally, Kansas City flipped out. Mahomes flipped out on the sideline. Mahomes flipped out after the game. Mahomes' comments after the game, he said, quote, another game, we're talking about the refs. It's not what we want for the NFL. It's not what we want for football. Let us play the game. Then whatever happens, happens. I find that statement remarkably myopic. Like, yes, you do play football. And yes, fans like seeing great players make great plays in football games. However, and you hear this in a lot of sports, there's this idea that the refs are supposed to swallow the whistle at the very end of things because nobody's here for the refs. You're not. But what's the point of obeying the rules for 99.5% of the game, but then deciding when everything is at stake, they don't matter? And Mahomes' comment, let us play the game, then whatever happens, happens. That just reeks to me of like the entitlement of every wealthy, powerful person on earth right now. Like, look, just let us do what we're doing, okay? Yeah, capitalism has regulations, but like, just let us do what we're doing. Let Elon Musk just do what he's doing. He's a genius. Just let him do what he's doing. Don't impede the great man. Patrick Mahomes is a wonderful, wonderful athlete. So we don't want to enforce the rules at the end of the game because then we wouldn't be able to see him make an exciting play. What the hell is the point of having the rules to then decide they don't matter when everything is at stake? That's the opposite of what rules and values should be. They should matter the most when everything is at stake. You see this in society. I don't know if this seems like a wacky, jumping off point, but all these people who seem to have, to me, very, very, you know, put it on a poster level values and moralities until genocides start happening in Palestine, in Sudan, in Congo, against the Armenians, everywhere around the world. But particularly, I would say, what's happening with the Palestinians. Because it's happening in real time. It's mediated. It's there for everyone to see. All these people who have very clear, strong senses of morality, suddenly not so much. Suddenly their values, when they're pushed to the forefront, don't apply. And that's Patrick Mahomes, to me, Okay, I know. It's just a football game, and he's in the heat of the moment. But this is not the heat of the moment. This is the game afterwards. You're a fucking grown-ass man. I am so tired. This whole story reeks to me of boys will be boys. You just have to accept that. You don't have to accept someone being an asshole. The referee did his job. The referee's job is not to stand there and you know, debate, well, should I or is this a time when anyone wants to hear from me? If he sees someone is breaking an obvious rule, which, by the way, no one's argued that here. Tony was lined up, in fact, after the game. The referee, Carl Cheffers, said that Tony's quote alignment was over the ball, and that's what he, the other official, ruled on the field. Andy Reid, the Chiefs coach, another expert in deflecting responsibility, had pointed out that the referees often will advise a team, hey, you know, watch out, that guy's lined up in the neutral zone, that guy's lined up offsides. And again, the official, Carl Cheffer, said, if a coach or a player looks for advice on whether or not they are lined up properly, officials will give it to them, but, quote, ultimately they are responsible for wherever they line up. I don't know why this is so hard for people, particularly people, I don't know if it's worse with people in power and with money, or if it just seems that way because everything seems worse with people with power and money. But why do we have to explain to you that you're responsible for your actions? Why does Patrick Mahomes have to erupt and be a child and then bring scorn and derision to a man in a profession that is already scapegoated to the millionth degree? When what happened? Your player was not where he belonged, and he got called for it. The referee continued, quote, and certainly no warning is required, especially, and I think this is important, if they are lined up so far off sides where they're actually blocking our view of the ball. So we would give them some sort of warning if it was anywhere close, but this particular one is beyond warning. So then, once he had a night to sleep on it, grown adult Patrick Mahomes tried to make it better by saying this, quote, I mean, obviously you don't want to react that way. I mean, I care, man. I love it. I love this game. I love my teammates. And I want to go out there and put everything on the line to win. But obviously can't do that. Can't be that way towards officials or really anybody in life. Okay, first, we don't need the rundown of like, boy, he's just a boy who cares so much about sports. I mean, I care, man. I love it. I love this game. I love my teammates. Nobody cares. If Patrick Mahomes had talked after the game about how he hates football and hates his teammates, then this comment would mean something. But the reason that this is a story is because you went out of your way to put an official on blast for doing his job. And the next day, all you can talk about is, I just love the game so much. I love my teammates. I just can't wait to put everything on the line. But obviously can't do that. Well, if it's so obvious, why'd you do it? Why is there not just a direct apology to the official by name? I'd like to apologize to so-and-so. He made the correct call. As disappointed as we were in the result, it's our job to play and do our jobs. It's the official's jobs to make the right call, and they did. That's what he could say. Then what does he say? More than anything, I regretted the way I acted toward Josh Allen after the game. Because after the game, Mahomes was still pissed about what happened. And when the players from the two teams will greet each other on the field afterwards, Mahomes was still pissed and like griping about the call. He didn't blame Josh Allen. He didn't direct anything negative at Josh Allen. Again, all that was directed at the official who did their job. But Mahomes says that more than anything, he regrets the way he acted toward Josh. He added, quote, I was still hot and emotional, but you can't do that, man. It's not a great example for kids watching the game. So I was more upset about that than I was about his reaction to the refs. Again, it's Draymond all over. Are you missing the point? Josh Allen wasn't upset. Josh Allen wasn't put in a position where he's going to get hate mail. He's going to get death threats. He's going to get negativity from strangers online. He's going to see his name. That had nothing to do with Josh Allen. You see this a lot. You see this so many times. Someone is wronged, and the so-called apology is exclusively directed at everyone who was not wronged. You can apologize to both. If you feel that badly, go ahead. Apologize to Josh Allen, but apologize to the person that you wronged. And you hear the last thing that Mahomes quoted feels to me like it could come right out of Draymond's mouth. Quote, I obviously didn't act in the way I usually act. And if there's consequences that come from it, then I have to accept those. What a wonderful way of saying nothing. I obviously didn't act in the way I usually act. And if there's consequences, meaning we all know there may not be and probably won't be, then I have to accept those. It's not noble for you to articulate that you don't have a choice in something. I'm allergic to pine nuts, okay? If I cook something with pine nuts, I struggle to breathe. I'm not going to cook something with pine nuts and then afterwards tell someone, well, you know, if I find myself in the ambulance later struggling to breathe, I have to accept those consequences. No, what I have to do is not eat pine nuts. That's the mistake. That's the triggering action. If I don't eat pine nuts, there's no consequences. If you don't unfairly slander a referee for doing their job, then there's no consequences. It's very simple. The last note, I actually got excited about this at the end of a game I could not care less about. I was trying to avoid some work on Sunday. They were televising the Baltimore Ravens and the LA Rams game here. And at the end of the game, there was an instance that came up that made me think of something I've always wondered about. And a few of you have asked about potting about this, and I am trying to work toward this for a future episode. You see things sometimes that make you really imagine, like, if this wasn't all built around capitalism, like, how different would everything be? And in a recreational sense, even with sports, sometimes it's interesting. If economic survival and affluence wasn't tied into work. So, like, you watch an NFL game. This happened in the Ravens game with the Rams. The game was tied with about 8 seconds left, and the Ravens had the ball. And the Ravens quarterback, Lamar Jackson, is, like, an astonishing quarterback. Not only can he throw the ball, but he's an unbelievable running quarterback. He's a double threat on a level almost nobody else is. So there's 8 seconds left. The call that got called back that had Mahomes all upset in the Kansas City game was this crazy play where he threw a pass to Travis Kelce, and 99.9% of the time when an NFL receiver catches the ball, they're either going to run out of bounds or they're going to run until someone tackles them. Kelce caught the ball, and Kadarius Toney was behind him, so he was allowed to throw it backwards to Toney. Because all the defense was zeroing in on Kelce, Toney was wide open. So when he got the ball, he just ran into the end zone. This can happen when you want to play with a bunch of laterals. 8 seconds left in a game that's tied is exactly the instance where a team runs that kind of a play. You run a bunch of laterals, you try to use misdirection, you try to do something different to fool the defense, and you can maybe break a big run and win the game. When you have a quarterback who can throw and run the way Lamar Jackson can, this is even more of a threat. But of course, it's the NFL, and coaches are afraid of taking any risk, because if you risk and you mess up, you lose. And if you lose, you lose your job. So you don't get visionaries. You get risk-averse, like, cowards. And instead of getting, like, a coach like Pep Guardiola, who you see in soccer, is all about, let's make the game as free and open and beautiful as it can be. In the NFL, you don't get that. You get a lot of, like, all right, you get what John Harbaugh did in this game with Baltimore, where what did he have his quarterback do? Just take a knee, run out the clock. We'll go to overtime and hope to win then. You weren't really in any more danger of losing with 8 seconds left. I would guess if you tried one play with 8 seconds left and it didn't work, probably the result is still that you go to overtime. But it's not conventional to lose on a gamble play with 8 seconds left. It is conventional to lose in overtime. So as a fan, you're sitting there thinking, wow, 8 seconds left. Incredible athlete at quarterback. Maybe I'll get to see something I've never seen before. Instead, you watch him take a knee and go to overtime, because that's conventional, that's safe, and the person who's coaching doesn't want to lose their job by taking a risk. I wish we would see less of this. I know it's total pie in the sky, but just, it would be nice to just see people coaching with a recognition that we're watching because we want to be thrilled and entertain, and we want to transcend our day-to-day life, not because we want to see you do the probabilistically most conservative decision. Like, that's not why anyone's watching. So that's it for this portion of the episode. Please stay tuned now for the interview with Noah Dalzell. Remember, as always, follow us on Twitter at Jacobin Sports. Yes, there is a new show name coming. I am not going to announce it until, I think, episode 100. But I do believe I have settled on the new title, so I'll be excited to share that soon. We'll still be Jacobin Sports for now. Please remember, as always, voting does not matter, but subscribing to our Patreon does. Patreon.com/Jacobin Sports Show. That's all for this episode. Thank you, everybody. Peace. So for today's guest, I would like to welcome a writer who has been making quite a name for themselves. They write for the Boston Celtics. They cover the Boston Celtics, I should say, at Celtics Blog and at Houdini Celtics. They also cover the WNBA at Swish Appeal. If you remember when we had Howard Beck on, Howard Beck had recently subscribed to Authory.com, which is a great site if you are someone who writes a lot on the internet, or if you are someone who likes to read someone's writing. It's kind of a, basically consolidates all the things that you write at different sites into one site. So if you're interested, Authory.com/Noah Dalzell. Spoiler, today's guest is Noah Dalzell. Noah, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I'm very excited to have you on today. When the show originated, it was shared hosting duties between myself and the great Jonah Birch, who's an enormous Celtic fan. So this is a nice kind of shout out to what the show used to be a lot about, which was a lot of talk about the Celtics. So I want to start by asking you about a player that I feel like, this is not certainly uniform to the Celtics, but I spoke with Keith Smith right around when the season started about Jason Tatum, and how from the outside, Jason Tatum strikes me as a player that pretty much every team, every fan base would love to have. But as we know, with every fan base and every player, some people see things that others don't. I'm curious, Celtics have a very successful season so far, but their whole kind of proof of concept will come in the playoffs. Everything for this team is playoffs. But having said that, what is the response so far to how Tatum has looked this year? Is there a general confidence among the fan base that, like, yeah, this is our guy, this is the guy who's going to get us there? Or is there any anxiety with the Celtics coming short in recent years that Keith Smith alluded to the fact that not all the Celtic fans were as devoted to Jason Tatum as you might see from the outside? What has been your perception of Tatum's play this year?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot there. So first, I think Tatum has had a really good year so far. He was named Player of the Month for the Eastern Conference last month, which essentially entailed like October, November. There was a lot of like, not backlash, but surprise even among like Celtics fans, because it doesn't feel like he's played like his absolute best basketball. There's certainly months that have stood out much more from an efficiency standpoint. Something that he's struggled with a little bit, especially in the last, you know, 10 or so games, is three-point shooting. Those people that tune into all Celtics games know that sometimes he pulls up for, you know, early clock, shot clock three-pointers, and you kind of think to yourself, you know, maybe he should be more physically dominating, or, you know, driving to the basket, things like that. And so, like any superstar, he you know, doesn't play a perfect game every night. I think sometimes people are looking a little bit too much at like his efficiency stats, how many points he's putting up. Right now he's averaging like 27.5 points per game or something in that range, which is a couple points less than he was averaging last year. And I think those numbers, as well as like kind of all of the stars numbers in the Celtics right now, are a lot more about the fact that this is such a loaded roster that everyone's touches, shots, you know, is taking a little bit of a hit. This roster, though, was constructed so that he doesn't have to be Luka. He doesn't have to be, you know, James Harden on the Rockets. Like, that's not his role. Maybe some people would love to see him go off for 40 every night, and I think he definitely could do that. But that's not his role on this team. And even last night, you know, the Celtics beat the Cavaliers. Joe Mazzulla, after the game, said that was one of Tatum's most dominant all-around performances. And I think he shot 7 of 19 from the field and had 25
points.
But he said it was one of the best overall games he's seen him play. And so there's a lot of other things that maybe the most, you know, the more casual Boston sports fan that tunes in once in a while might not pick up on, like screen assists, like how much, you know, how much the defense is really like all over him, and it opens up opportunities for other guys like Derek White, who's having a phenomenal year, in large part because he's being, you know, he's sharing the court with these stars that are getting so much attention. So I would say, you know, he's had a good start to the year so far, but nothing where it's like he's playing out of his mind. Will he be able to keep this up? I think he's playing in a way that, look, I expect him to always play. And then probably he'll go through stretches in the year where his three-point shot's more efficient. He had a little bit of a stretch where he was turning the ball over a bit. That's, you know, not super out of character, but some of the passes, some of the plays were a little out of character. So I think he's kind of at his like baseline, you know, basketball right now. And it's only going to go from here, and the team's doing really well, and he's playing well, and he's been, you know, getting rewarded for it.
Yeah. I mean, it's to me, it's major first world problems when you've got your best player is like young. He's only scoring 27 and a half. He plays defense. He moves the ball. By all accounts, he seems to be like a popular teammate. Like,
yeah,
I'd love to have whatever problems anybody has with Jason Tatum, like anywhere.
He's also a real rebounder, I'll add. He's like the best defensive rebounder that's on center in the league right now. So,
wow. Yeah. So game. Enjoy that guy. another Celtic who gets also, at least from the outside, appears to get a lot of shade, Jaylen Brown, has the same standard applied where, like, okay, the team has been built in a way that there's so much talent, there's so much high-end talent, there's so much diversity of skill set across the roster that Tatum doesn't have to do everything that he used to. Does that apply also to Brown? Has his role or anything changed or evolved in light of the additions of White, the additions of Porzingis? What's your take been on how Brown has looked this season?
I think he's looked solid. He's had a couple of bad games, but this most recent stretch, he's looked pretty good. Same deal with Tatum. I think his numbers are going to go down a little bit. He's averaging around 22 a game right now, which is a little bit less than he was averaging last year. He's been pretty efficient. He's shooting 47% from the field. With Brown, the narrative's always two things. It's, can you go left? Does he have like those really dramatic loose ball turnovers where he kind of dribbles it off his foot and doesn't look like a superstar NBA player? And he doesn't even have that many of those, but whenever he does, they go viral and they're on SportsCenter and everyone's sharing them. And then the other piece for him is the playmaking. There was an ESPN graphic last week that said, you know, he attempted 43 shots over two games and had zero assists. And he actually posted that graphic on his own story, sending maybe some sort of message. But the thing with him is always like he's a head down player is the kind of trope around him. I've seen a huge playmaking leap from him this year. He's been averaging more assists, but also more importantly, more potential assists. The Celtics like to always emphasize that, you know, it's, you have to have the guy make the shot for the assist to count. But you can just tell just from like the, you know, just from watching, he'll drive to the basket and shots that last year, it's like 100% chance he's going to take that difficult layup or that difficult pull-up jump shot. Now he's looking to make the extra pass very often. So I think that he's actually made from the eye test, he's made like significant strides. And I think statistically there hasn't been an enormous jump. But to most people that have been following the team, that's kind of been the impression. So Tatum and Brown, they're still the two go-to guys on this team. The offense is still structured mostly around them. Guys like Porzingis, Holiday, White, they'll maintain that. They'll keep saying, you know, I'm here to be the role player. Those are the two guys. That being said, they don't need to go for 30 every night. They need to go for maybe 20 every night and have other guys step up. And it's better to keep the defense guessing that it's not going to be, you know, Tatum gets the ball with 10 seconds left on the shot clock and he's going to go one-on-one against his man, or Brown does the same. Now they have all these other weapons, so they'll both benefit from that. But I think they both had a good start to the year. Brown is just one of the most over-scrutinized players in the league for some reason. And so a lot of times if you actually tune in and actually follow his basketball, he's actually having a much better stretch than maybe the Twitter or the media might show.
So Brown and Tatum have been the, you know, kind of core Celtics for a while. Looking at a couple new or newer Celtics, I love Jrue Holiday. I love any team that has Jrue Holiday. I was very interested in how this would play out for Boston, because generally when you get rid of Marcus Smart, like, you're losing something defensively that you can't get back. And they're not the same player. They're both great defensive players, but you manage to add one of the few arguments over Smart as the best defensive guard in the league, not to mention a much more consistent shooter. What has it been like watching the team? I guess not just in terms of, I'm interested on the court, what it's like having Holiday versus Smart, but also Smart's value went so much beyond between the 94 feet. Smart was this vocal, even if you weren't a Celtic fan, you could feel it from miles away. Like, he is the heart. So what has it been like on a team with, you know, a second year coach, not a guy who's been here, like implementing his culture in his way? What has it been like for the team to adjust to a different leadership, I suppose, standard, given that, and Holiday in general, what his addition has been like?
Yeah, so I'll be honest, when they did the Smart Porzingis trade, I was pretty critical of it. And I think Porzingis has been an awesome player for the team and had an awesome year last year too. But getting rid of Marcus Smart to me felt like potentially really dangerous. And I didn't know how that was going to affect the team. And we'll never really know because, like you said, we got a guy that's one of the few guys in the league that actually might be able to come in and play that role with an additional skill set. Mm-hmm. And so Marcus Smart, you know, everybody, you've heard it a million times now. He was the heart and soul of the team. He was the vocal leader. He was a beloved teammate, fan favorite. There's no one quite like him. And first thing I did was buy tickets before I even started covering the team for Celtics blog, was make sure that I could be at the, you know, Grizzly Celtics game. Everyone's looking forward to February 4th to see him back in the Garden. Drew Holiday, though, adds versatility, especially defensively. He's able to match up against Giannis, Julius Randle, Karl Anthony Towns. He's been tasked with oftentimes guarding the opposing team's best big, which is certainly not what Marcus Smart was used for. He could switch, and sometimes he'll draw a charge and Embiid or something fun like that. And, you know, he could do that in small stretches, but that was not his role defensively. So just Holiday's a lot more versatile in that sense. Mm-hmm. So that's been a huge plus to have the backcourt of him and Derek White. Defensively, there's no backcourt in the league that rivals it. And Derek White's talked extensively, you know, he was second team all defense last year. Holiday was first team all defense last year. Derek White's talked extensively about how much easier it's been for him to play with Holiday on the court, not necessarily in comparison to Smart, but he's just really kind of talked very highly of Holiday's defensive abilities and how it's kind of opened up things for him, allowed him to try things. Sometimes if you just watch the Celtics for a couple possessions in a row defensively and you just watch Holiday, it's like he's guarding four guys every possession. He's literally everywhere. There's a reason why every year players, you know, the athletic poll has, you know, asks players who's the best defender in the league. I've listened to plenty of player podcasts. They all say Holiday's the best defensive player in the league. There's a reason for that. So we're certainly seeing it. The Celtics fan base, it didn't take long to, he has had zero drop off on the defensive end. And then another thing I'll say is I wrote an article earlier this year for Celtics blog before this trade, before the Holiday trade, about how it's highly unusual for a team to win a championship without anybody on the roster that has previously won a championship. And I went through like the last 25 years of championships. And normally it's either like you're repeating with the same core, like the Warriors or, you know, a group that's already like the main guys have already won before, or you have at least a couple of vets that have won, you know, in their younger days. And maybe they were more pivotal players there, but they can talk about what that experience was like the KCPs of the world, that, you know, he wasn't the go-to guy, but he still has that lived experience of winning a championship. And that's something the Celtics have been lacking. They added Sam Cassell and he, you know, to the coaching staff. And so at the time that was kind of what my article was about, that they thought that could be huge. Now you have Drew Holiday, who's actually won at the highest level and was a huge part of that Milwaukee Bucks 2021 championship. And so that is something else that, you know, when he talks, he has that credibility. There's plenty of veteran voices in this group, but I think Holiday has that unique advantage now that he actually knows how to do it. Everybody else knows that he did it. And that leadership is going to be really important as well. And he's a great guy. Marcus Smart was like a community fixture. He was super involved with the hospital work, with sick children. He's done a ton of philanthropy. And Drew Holiday is also that type of person. So I think from that sense, it's nice that we got another great guy in the community that can come in and kind of play that role as well, not just on the court.
It's funny, as I cover the Knicks, and I remember when Porzingis first came into the league for New York, Boston was the first team with Smart who played like a small guarding KP and showed that it, and Smart's exceptional. So like Smart, it worked. KP could not move him. Yeah. Team, and now I see Holiday on the Celtics, and when they play the Knicks and I see him guarding Randle, in almost any case, if there's a guard on Randle, like great, like easy money. And when you see it's Holiday, you're like, oh God, like this is going to be a turnover. This is going to be something negative. Just what a great, it must be really, really nice to just for years you've been able to watch. Like, I know there's a stat that always floats around that I think these Celtics have won. Maybe it's that they've won the most games without winning a finals in like
in the last 7 years, they've won more games, playoff games, than any team in a 7 year stretch without winning a championship. Which is why the fans are always so negative, I think.
Yeah, I got to tell you, like, and I get it. There's different standards for different, like, franchises. But when I think about just you've gotten to watch Marcus Smart defend for years, and then you got to watch Holiday, you've got to watch Tatum grow, you've gotten to watch Brown grow. Like, it's not the worst. It's not the worst life. Like, even without a title, it's really not the worst life. Speaking of Porzingis, this is particularly interesting to me, obviously, as a Knicks fan, but just also just I love basketball anomalies. I love when anyone comes into the league who just their body and their game are doing something different that you're not used to seeing. Smart is like this, Holiday. Yeah. Even someone like PJ Tucker is just kind of a physical anomaly in terms of what he does. So Porzingis has always been exciting to me, especially waiting to see like what happens when this guy ends up on a team. Because I think he's always been – he reminds me of, you know, Alec Baldwin was like this as an actor. He's cast for years as the lead. And then at some point, he ages into, I think, a better role, which is like you're a wonderful character actor. You have the face of a lead, but like you're really a wonderful, wonderful – and I think that's his zone. Porzingis, he's drafted, you know, top five. He's huge. He's a unicorn. So the initial take is like he's going to be like with the Knicks, he's going to be the star. He's going to be, but I don't think that's really his thing. Yeah. And I think he's talked about how, yeah, in Dallas he was young and him and Luka had a little like back and forth. But you see, when you watch them this year with the Celtics, it looks like this is absolutely perfect casting. Like he is a superstar role player. He gives them things that they need. He gives them rim protection. He gives them a big who can. Like when they play the Knicks, it's a nightmare watching, having to watch your team defend now five out, at least with Robert Williams there. Like it could be a little more conventional and no, strictly first, just in terms of on the court. What's been the vibe to KP among Celtic fans?
Yeah. I mean, he started off super hot too, which is always nice for a new addition. Like he went through a little bit of a cold shooting stretch more recently, but he started off like really showing people, especially with that opening game in Madison Square Garden, like showing people, you know, we're happy to have him. I think he's added an element to the Celtics offense that was really needed, being a really reliable post presence. Al Horford, I could not be, you can't find a bigger Al Horford fan than me. I think he's been just absolutely tremendous for the Celtics, but he's not a really a much of a post presence anymore. And for the, for Tatum and Brown to be able to play off of him, and I think we're still just starting to see the beginnings of what that two-man game can look like with Porzingis, it changes everything. Brown in particular, they've really hit it off as friends, and much has been made of that. But it's really, from a playmaking standpoint, they've had a wonderful kind of two-man game going that I think has allowed him to be more of a playmaker. He's getting backdoor cuts, so it's been really, really fun to watch. And then he's also a much better defender than I think I had anticipated, than maybe he's been in the past or has been advertised to be in the past. So he's been pretty versatile, switching, pretty good rim protector. So from a defensive standpoint, like I don't think he has the ceiling that Robert Williams has. And they both are injury prone in their own rights, but he hasn't felt like much of a drop off. And the Celtics defense has been really good. You know, 1 through 5, they have really good you know, personnel. And kind of both sides of the court, I think he's been really impressive.
Let me ask you one more on the court question, which is Joe Mazzulla, second year coach, came into the job unexpectedly in unexpected circumstances. Anyone who takes over any team with the title aspirations the Celtics had was going to be highly scrutinized, but taking over this team, this stacked, when he did, there's a lot of pressure on Joe Mazzulla. It's year two now. Has he done enough and put enough of an imprint yet that the fan base has a sense of who Joe Mazzulla is, what a Joe Mazzulla team is? Is it clearly distinct from what Ime Udoka was doing before then? What is the read on Joe Mazzulla a little over a year into his time as Celtic head coach?
Yeah, he was really scrutinized last year, and probably if the Celtics don't come back to push the Heat series to Game 7, there is no Joe Mazzulla in Celtics anymore. So I think he was in a tough spot. He didn't have the summer to prepare. He didn't have his own coaching staff. It was Udoka's staff. They're in Houston now, and he was kind of forced into that precarious position. He looks a lot more comfortable and a lot more confident this year, just from like a vibe standpoint, just being in press conferences with him. I remember last year it was like short answers. He was very defensive. He didn't look comfortable like being there. He's not at all like that anymore. Like he's done a 180 from a personality standpoint, as far as just being willing to be open, honest, kind of just just completely different in the public eye. I think from like a coaching philosophy standpoint, one of his like sticking points or one of his big things has been 3-point shooting. Like he wants to get a lot of threes up. That's, you know, he's an analytics guy. He's crunched the numbers. He's studied everything that there is to study in the game of basketball. That's his strength. He's talked a lot about studying momentum, studying runs, things like that. And so some of the pushback has been like, oh, this is a team that settles for threes too much. He's maintained you need to do that in order to be a winning NBA basketball team in this current era. The challenge is that you have some guys who aren't like phenomenal 3-point shooters, like Tatum and Brown and Porzingis are shooting like around league average right now. It's not like that's their thing is 3-point shooting. And so at points, like that's been some of the critique from him is that he's maybe his team has been overly reliant on the 3-pointer. And that was definitely a thing last year in the playoffs. Like all of a sudden they couldn't hit anything from the outside. And it seemed like the whole offense was revolving around that. So one thing that they've added this year is like more of a post-up game. And Tatum's been big on that. Porzingis has been, I think, one of the most efficient players in the league from post-ups. And Sam Cassell has been a big part of that. So he's kind of added a staff where like each guy has their thing. He has their specialty and like they're able to kind of build upon that initial like three ball philosophy that I don't think he's straying away from. Like I still think he thinks that's, you know, threes attempted in the game is a super important metric to indicating if a team has a good chance to win. But that's just from a philosophy standpoint. I think he's a little more open-minded. And then the other thing that he's gotten really scrutinized for is timeouts. He oftentimes will not call a timeout when the other team is going on a run and kind of wants like the guys to figure it out on their own. I think he's moved a little bit away from that. I'd be interested in looking at like the actual timeout numbers in those runs. I don't know if like they've substantially changed, but certainly that's like a big critique of his is that he'll just like let things play out. My perspective on like being a basketball player my whole life is that the timeout is more for stopping the other team's momentum than for like anything that you might say. And so even if he doesn't want to come in and change the game plan, like let's just like put a pause on this, like a quarter break. That's my opinion at least. But yeah. I think it's just overly discussed. Like a lot of things, like there's just like you fall into these tropes, like the Jaylen Brown left hand thing, the Missoula timeout thing. Like it's just, you know, you pick up on, you hear it on sports radio and then you say it over and over again. And then it kind of becomes like this much bigger storyline than it actually is. And I think that's one of them. So I think overall he's done a really good job. I mean, he has the buy-in of the players. That's the most important thing. They've talked very positively of him. Porzingis has said, you know, he's a great motivator. He's charismatic. He knows how to kind of appeal to each and every guy. Tatum and Brown last year really maintained that as well. So, you know, Brad Stevens is a wonderful GM. We've seen that with his offseason moves. I don't think he would have chosen this guy and kept this guy and signed him to a longer term contract if he didn't have like the utmost faith that he was cut out for this job. And like, yeah, there's going to be some wrinkles in the early days. I was talking to Jared Sullinger last year, former Celtics player. And he was saying that, you know, when Brad Stevens started, there was the first year was tough and then you kind of put it all together in the second year and you're able to use the analytics brain and the personality and the experience and everything to be a really good NBA coach. And I think we're seeing more of that with Missoula right now as well in his second year.
Nice. Very nice. I want to turn to an off the court topic. You wrote a piece 3 months ago that hits on something that we've spoken about on this pod in the last few episodes. Specifically, if anyone's looking for it, it's under the title, "We Need to Change the Way We Talk About Domestic Violence in the NBA." This came out in mid-September. I don't even know when you wrote it, if the second Miles Bridges incident had happened yet. You touched on Kevin Porter, who we talked about, Miles Bridges. There's a couple points you make in this. It's an enormous issue, and I know that like we've already spoken a lot, but there's two points that you made that I really want to draw attention to that really stood out to me. One, I had talked about this earlier also, that one thing I find very disappointing is that Adam Silver is not paralyzed by like the bylaws of the NBA. Adam Silver has spoken explicitly about if a player crosses the line, his terminology, like there will be consequences. And Kevin Porter could have been, you know, suspended. Miles Bridges, after the second offense, could have been suspended. And instead, we're getting press releases from the Hornets about how they're glad to have him back. And apparently that did not cross the line. An interesting note you make after your point about that the league, you say, we know the league has been more comfortable handing out larger suspensions for non-violent offensive, and it's critical here that the punishment fits the crime. Then you wrote, "Domestic violence is by no means limited to the NBA, but studies show that professional athletes are more likely to physically assault their partners. NBA athletes have a domestic violence arrest rate of 38.2% higher than the general population, and NFL athletes have an even higher DV arrest rate, 55.4% higher than the national average. It's not just men either. WNBA player Raquena Williams was barred from the Las Vegas Aces earlier this year after allegedly striking her wife. So I'm interested first in just what led you to this piece. Did you know this information? Because I feel like anecdotally there's a lot of like conversation about, I think athletes are more violent. Well, I just think there's more publicity, but you're finding actual data showing that there are numbers to back up that this is even more prevalent, sadly, in these arenas. Is there any, did you find any links or explanations as to why the rate is higher among the community of professional athletes?
Yeah. So first of all, what led me to this piece is that I've been, you know, a lifelong NBA fan and also a woman who has followed the NBA. And from that perspective, it feels like, you know, and I follow media, I follow all the, you know, criticism, radios, national news, everything. And it's, you know, we see things all the time where a guy might not play well. Like earlier this week, there was this whole thing around Zion Williamson and how he is fat. That was the narrative. And, you know, there were some absurd quotes that came out of Stephen A. Smith. So it's like we're comfortable criticizing people, even pretty ruthlessly, even when we don't know the full story, like who actually really knows what's going on there, mental health, things like that. Like we don't really know all the details, but we're very comfortable as a society to come out and say like pretty wild things. When it comes to this issue, which is really to me, putting your hands on another person, being violent, threatening someone's life is the worst thing that someone can do. We all of a sudden were very quiet, and I don't really know why that is. I think it's uncomfortable whenever there is like unproven allegations. Obviously, there's a reason why we have a criminal justice system. I'm not saying, you know, every time someone is accused of something, they need to be banned for life. But our general attitude has been to like kind of shy away from having these conversations, to shy away from criticizing players that have been accused, convicted, pleaded guilty, pleaded no contest. And so it kind of has stuck out to me for a long time. I remember even like when I first became a fan and heard about like Jason Kidd was as a kid, and I was thinking like, that's wild that he's like this beloved guy, Hall of Famer, yep. And now he's becoming a coach, and like that's something that's in his background. And so it's something that I've always thought about. And then the Miles Bridges incident was interesting because he, in effect, was actually only suspended 10 games because he missed last season anyways. I think, you know, what's 10 games? You know, it's a couple of weeks of NBA basketball, right? So, you know, after all of that, and we had photos, it was like right there in the public eye. It was, you know, as public as you can get. And so, and even so, he just, all he had ended up happening was that he missed a couple of weeks. And so it's pretty frustrating to watch.
It's a hamstring pull. It's the same as a hamstring pull.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so to me, it's not about blaming one person. I've been critical of Adam Silver. I think that he can take a much stronger stance, both in his rhetoric and also in like the execution of punishments and kind of policies. But it's just everybody. It's like the media talking about this. It's fans. Like I remember like I follow like fan bases and media and journalists from like every fan base. So my Twitter is not Celtics Twitter. And I remember like all the Rockets fans and, you know, reporters were like, oh my gosh, this is such a setback for our team. Like immediately, like moments after the allegation came out. Wow. And that was like, that was so hard to watch. Like that's thing, you know? And so I think those were all just like thoughts in the back of my mind. I'm not an expert on domestic violence or domestic violence policy. Definitely. I did a lot of research when I was kind of getting into this, and it's something that I definitely want to continue to learn about, but there's much better voices as far as actually talking about the psychology and kind of the best punishments and the best rehabilitation, things like that. It doesn't shock me that athletes have a higher rate than the rest of the population. I think there's a lot of potential reasons for that. I mean, you have this already uneven power dynamic with money, with influence, with fame. You also have like clearly physically, there's like this competitive nature. There's something psychologically that's different about someone that allows them to be a successful NBA player. And hopefully, usually that's a positive difference, and it's a competitive spirit and it's something like that. But I understand that maybe sometimes that's actually manifested in a negative way. Even just watching a guy like Draymond Green, I have no idea how he is off the court. Hopefully it's nothing bad. But just watching him like repeatedly strike players for like really no good reason. It doesn't shock me that sometimes once in a while you get a guy that actually like that translates off the court as well. Especially when you have that uneven power dynamic. Yeah, those were kind of all things that I thought about. I think there's so much more that needs to happen in this space as it comes to the NBA. And then also like players should do more on this. And I've I'm like a huge fan of, I'm a huge fan of like players off the court, and how they act off the court really matters to me as far as like how I perceive them, how I think about them. That's why I'm really excited to have like Drew Holiday, Jaylen Brown, guys that have been like really vocal advocates. I have not seen players really say anything about this. So that's something else that to me is like, LeBron James can go out and say like there's zero place for domestic violence in the NBA. I'm concerned about the increasing trend. Like, it would not do much, but it would send a signal from his peers that like this is the most respected guy in the league. He's saying this is wrong. He's making it uncomfortable next time the Hornets play the Lakers, you know, that he just kind of spoke out against you. And like, that just hasn't happened. So those were like, some of my considerations as I put this piece together.
Yeah, you made an excellent point. And this struck me, it was a different issue, but a couple of years ago, just in terms of a discussion of, you know, bodily autonomy and the NBA's respect or not respect towards it, when Kyrie Irving during the pandemic had announced that he was not going to play for the Nets in New York in solidarity with workers who were not getting vaccinated and therefore could not go to work, he expressed it very much as like, this is a bodily autonomy issue. And like, I have to be in solidarity with these people. It's not right that they don't have autonomy over their body. He gets traded to a team in Texas, a state that has made codified into law, like slightly more than half our population is not going to enjoy bodily autonomy when it comes to reproductive rights. Like, we're not gonna, not a peep, not a word, I didn't hear a single NBA player say anything when states began, especially states where NBA teams play, where any laws were being passed on restricting reproductive rights, women's body autonomy, and you wrote about it also in your piece, how, and you don't even think about this when it happens, but when that sprinter, Noah Lyles, makes this very innocuous just statement about, well, you really can't call NBA players world champions because it's in a national league, it's not a global, there's an immediate hot, independent, non-provoked, I mean, it's authentic. All these players have things to say. And it does make you, and you made a point in your piece that it's not just something that happens in men's sports. It also happens, it's happened in the WNBA. And I've questioned at times also sometimes in the past, that league sometimes spotlight and addressing other things. But I think it would, like you're saying with LeBron, just the spot, like the fact that LeBron was completely willing to call out Daryl Morey for saying something about Hong Kong's right, like to be free, like that's we're gonna make this a thing, and it's not about one player, it's not about LeBron because he does talk about a lot of things, he's one person who tries to do, but like you're saying, it never comes up when anything happens in the NBA, players want to talk about it. When this comes up, nothing. Nothing.
Yeah.
And there's such a code of silence that, like you're saying, foundationally, like when you're doing the rookie symposium, this should be something that is, I'm sure it is, but obviously there needs to be more, because I have a hard time, you know, I sit down and watch a game and there's nights where you realize, oh, okay, the guy talking has an abuse the announcer abused someone in the past. That coach has it. Oh, see the guy with the ball? Yeah, and then when he passed, like, sometimes you're just like, come on.
Yeah, like, and it's tough because also, like, it's such an honor and a privilege to be in the NBA. It's from the platform, from the money, from everything. And you have countless guys that are on the fringe of being in this league that are maybe playing overseas or in the G League that would do anything for this opportunity. And then you have people, because they're, like, maybe slightly more talented, they get the platform. And also, I think there's a lot of luck involved. Like, there's plenty of people that maybe things had fallen their way, they would be in the NBA. So it's just particularly tough to see. Like, there was this incident with Josh Primo. Like, he's now, you know, he signed a contract with the Clippers and it's like, he's a fringe NBA player. Like, he almost wasn't even in that role. And it's like, it doesn't even seem like those allegations are taken into account when you're making those decisions, as far as like maybe somebody else who's just as good as him or within that realm, you know, maybe he should get that opportunity. So it's tough because I don't have the mentality of like, if you do one thing bad or if you're accused of something, you should be canceled for life. You're irredeemable. Like, that's not my perspective on it. Yep. But I do think that you also can't sweep things under the rug, and we have to have, you know, public resolution to these things. Like, nobody even really knows what's happening with Miles Bridges right now. This is different, but like the Josh Giddey situation, nobody really knows what's happening there. Like, it's all happening on TikTok and Twitter. And like, the team hasn't said anything, you know? And so like, we just need to have a better process for these things, even if we're not going to say that every time someone does something wrong, they're barred from the league. And I also would like to see like violent and sexual crimes be ranked like higher on the punishment scale than things like drug usage, which ultimately just impacts the person in the sport and not anybody else. Or even things like John Morant, you know, putting his gun on Instagram Live. Like, I'm all that, you know, I think there's a lot of concerning implications of that, and like gun control and those issues are super important right now. But at the end of the day, like, he didn't put his hands on someone and he got a larger suspension than almost every guy that has. So those are all things that I thought about. I think from a player standpoint, I hate to be like sitting at home being like, oh, LeBron needs to talk about all the world issues and, you know, it's his responsibility. But I do think that like in particular issues that are relevant and related to the league, like, I'm not going to ask LeBron or any of these players to talk about every global issue, every, you know, conflict that's taking place. Like, they don't need to be the experts on all that. They don't need to be like a voice for every single cause. But when it comes to things like you're sharing the court with someone or plenty of people, I think those are the types of issues that like they have more of a responsibility and obligation to talk about. So I'm going to keep talking about it. Hopefully other people do as well. And hopefully we'll see, you know, 10, 20 years from now that there are better processes in place and that this isn't something that is just happens all the time. Like, you turn on the TV and like you said, that's what you see.
Yeah. And there needs to be recognition from the league. And I think this comes to still a need for evolving attitudes about who is an NBA fan and what does an NBA fan look like and live like. Like, this doesn't affect people who your fans know. These are your fans. Like, these are the people who make up the population that follows the NBA. And domestic violence is not just something that affects any one group of people. All of your groups of fans right. are subjected to this sort of thing. And for a league that loves to, you know, jump on, here's the in-season tournament, this is for the fans. Here's this new CBA tweak, this is for the fans. Well, this would really be something like for the fans. I remember, I'm gonna let you go in a minute here, but I just remember when the Knicks played the Hornets about, it was Miles Bridges' second game back from his this season. And the most striking juxtaposition of the game was LaMelo Ball had to wear a tag over a tattoo behind his ear because the NBA, the moment they saw, oh, you got a tattoo that advertises your own clothing line? No. Like, immediate response. Immediate. The NFL is like this too. The NFL for years would dog it on CTE stuff, but if your socks were hiked like 4 inches too high, they were right on it. And like you're saying, you can put your money where your mouth is. If this issue matters, we don't need to wait for Miles Bridges to make 2 offenses, 3 offenses, 4 offenses. Yeah. Like, we don't need to wait for that. You're that fast with the tattoo. Show us that this matters to you because it matters to us. And yeah. I, as a fan, like when the Charlotte game happened, my recap was entirely about highlighting places where readers could devote money or resources or attention to domestic violence centers, to what kinds of donations they don't get a lot of that they could use. There was no way to talk about the game because you can't watch that as a human and just be like, I'm watching a game. You can't. It's impossible. Impossible. Right. Will the Celtics win the title?
I think so. I mean, I think so for the last few years. So, but I think they look really good and they're in that small group of teams that have a really good chance as long as they stay healthy. Their core five has only lost one game together so far. So, wow. I feel pretty good about their chances. Yeah.
Nice. Before they go, do you have any stuff coming out to keep an eye out for? Anything that the readers or the listeners can be looking out for now or in the future from you, or where they should find you?
Yeah, my Twitter is probably the best place for new content. Just Noah Dalzell, NBA. I had a story come out last week that I was happy with. It was an interview with Derek White's dad. He talks a lot about kind of like the toxic culture amongst fans and just how we talk about them. So check that out if you get the chance. And I think next week I have a piece coming out. It was an interview with Jared Sullinger, former Celtics player, around how his time on the Celtics really shaped the trajectory of his career and how he's playing overseas and it's still so influenced by some of those early guys. So be on the lookout for that as well. Thanks so much for having me. This
is great. Yeah, I hope to have you on in the future. I read the Derek White piece for those listening. It is a delight. It's a delight just tonally, but also the implication of, like, it is possible to affect change in an environment that you wish would have some change. Like, it's a really affirming story in that sense. So it's not just entertaining and informative. It's also, like, actually uplifting. So that's it. Noah, thank you so much for being with us, and I hope to have you on maybe closer to the playoffs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too.